The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In Scarfolk, England, citizens are expected to schedule workplace accidents at the convenience of their employers. They also pay a gravity tax and enter a lottery to win the right to be acknowledged as human. All of these cultural quirks are meticulously archived on the town council website in faded 1970s pastels. For instance, one leaflet explains the physics tax from 1975 and reads, "As you know, gravity is supplied to you not unlike gas, electricity, or water. Creating, maintaining, and distributing the forces of physics is an expensive national undertaking, and the cost of running the gravity generator plant in Scarfolk costs millions of pounds annually." Sound dystopian? Orwellian? Well, luckily, it is. Scarfolk is a creepy work of fiction, but perhaps the most unnerving thing about it is the parallels it draws to our own world. Richard Littler is writer and designer and curator of the Scarfolk Council blog, an archive of England's most upsetting town that never existed. And Richard, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, Virginia. Thank you for having me.
So how did you get this idea of starting an archive of a fake town?
You know, I was hit 40 and I was trying to remember my early childhood. I'd read that people's memories are no longer their memories after a certain age, and they're sort of remembering a recollection of a memory of a memory. So I thought I'd try to build up as many memory fragments as I could of the early 70s. And I quickly realized that it's impossible. It's too fragmented, and your brain tends to fill in the gaps with who you've become. Everything becomes colored by who you are now. So I embraced the fictional aspect of what I could do with that.
Well, you grew up in Manchester. Was that a scary place where they had a gravity tax?
They didn't have a gravity tax, I must admit. I kind of made that up.
How about a thought detector van or a dream recording machine?
Oh, we did have thought detector vans. That is based in reality. We had TV detector vans. They would allegedly drive around suburban environments, checking to see whether you had a television or not. And then they would knock on your door to ensure that you had a license. And everyone was terrified of these vans. And no one was entirely sure whether or not the technology actually worked. But it certainly scared a lot of people.
Well, it sounds like a scary place, Scarfolk.
It is. Yeah, it is indeed. It's very unsettling.
Well, it also is written as an archive, and the town is pretty much perpetually trapped in the 1970s. So why that decade?
I suppose it's quite for personal reasons. I had so many fragments that I couldn't quite piece together. It just seemed a great time to base it. And also in the UK, it is considered to be a very strange, dark decade, politically, but culturally as well. It just seemed to fulfill all the criteria.
Well, we see on your blog, a faded and creased itinerary. This is from the Summer Fete, 1976. There's a puppet show at 11:30. There's an egg and spoon race. And then at 2:10, a terrorist bombing.
Yes.
So what was the process for you? Did you actually go back to old archival material for these PSA messages?
Oh, yes. I have an enormous, over the last two or three years, I've picked up an enormous amount of images. I have around 30,000 reference images in my folder. I'm constantly making sure that my images and texts are, you know, referencing something that happened in the past at some point or another. And this happened to us a lot. We had a lot of terrorism in the 1970s from the IRA. So you would have children's television programs quickly followed by a news report on a terrorist bombing, and then a public information message about drowning. So everything was juxtaposed very strangely.
Oh, that's terrifying in a little brain.
It is. It is.
Well, the graphics on the blog look shockingly like real relics from the 70s. Do people think it's real? Do they write to you and say, "Where did you find this?"
Yes, I mean not as much now because some people recognise the logo and the name, but certainly when I first started, a lot of people thinking they were genuine. Again, because the 1970s, you weren't really sure what people really thought. There were a lot of unusual cultural beliefs and ways of doing attitudes. So it does make it believable in some way when it's very extreme.
There are also covers of paperback books for adults and for kids, a series for kids. And there's a toy, it's called Mr. Liverhead, which sort of looks like Mr. Potato Head, except it's a liver as a head with little things stuck onto it. And I have to ask, after seeing a picture of this on the website, did you actually create one and then photograph it?
I went through all the siblings trying to get it right. No, I never did, actually. But it just seems a logical next step. I mean, I think that's what Scarfic is. It's reality just nudged a little bit over the edge.
Well, there are a few recent posts that seem to reflect the current nationalistic mood that led to the Brexit vote. I'm thinking of the foreigner identification badges. They look like little scouting badges, but their titles are Believer in a Non-English Speaking Deity or Foreign Visitor from an Ex-British Colony. Should it unnerve us to see reality reflected in a place like Scarfic?
I hope so. I hope that people will compare and contrast the attitudes we have now to the attitudes we had in the 70s, which were very outmoded. And it's interesting to see how far, if at all, we've developed. We have been living in a very absurd world at the moment. So a lot of my stuff, particularly recently, has touched on that.
Yeah, people seem to want stickers and T-shirts of this.
They have. We're trying to build towards that. And I hope that we'll be able to do something. But there's also always the danger of things being taken out of context, which you don't want.
Right. The Pepe the Frog would be an example.
Exactly. So you have to be careful. But yeah, it is something we would like to do.
Well, you are now working on a TV show. Is it based in Scarfic?
Yes, it is. A company called Retort Productions in England, who have a tradition of doing comedy, have taken the option, the rights for film and TV rights for the blog and the book. So we're in the early stages of development with that.
So are you envisioning what Scarfic would look like in 3D?
Yes, I have thought about it a lot, and of course, to me, it just looks like the inside of my head, as it always does. But it's some things, when you suddenly realise that they might actually be living, moving things, they might need some amendment and some adaptation because they're quite unusual.
There's a lot of paranormal going on there too. Was that present when you were growing up?
Very much so. There was a very strange attitude in Britain in the 1970s. Supernatural and the paranormal was ubiquitous on television and in children's books. And often there wasn't much of a differentiation between the two. You know, poltergeists would be presented as fact on the news. And you were all interested in the UFO culture, of course, and Loch Ness Monster. And it was all presented as fact a lot. So to a very young mind, you know, it all mixes together.
So the blog, the Scarfic Council blog, is trapped in the 1970s. Have you moved out of there, Richard?
Have I moved out of the 70s? I will always have a foot in there, I think. I think so. I mean, I literally have moved. I don't live in England anymore. I lived away from England for at least 15 or 20 years now, which gives it a whole different perspective. You know, I have expat syndrome, so I can reimagine the England of the past quite freely.
Well, Richard, thank you very much for speaking with us.
No problem at all. Thank you much for having me.
Richard Littler, he is a designer, writer, and the curator of the Scarfic Council blog. It's an archive of England's most upsetting town that never existed. And you can find a link to see it for yourself at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Hong Kong is home to just over 7 million people, or 6,690 people per square kilometer, making it one of the most densely populated places and one of the most competitive real estate markets in the world. Space is limited and expensive, and brokers will do almost anything to snag a listing. Enter Spacious.hk, a tech startup guiding expats and younger Hong Kongers to discounted listings as long as they're willing to put up with a few ghosts. The service offers deals on places where someone has died, something locals, especially the older generations, will not touch. Justin Heifetz is a freelance reporter based in Hong Kong. We found his article about the haunting practices of the Hong Kong real estate market on Motherboard. And Justin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
How dramatically does an at-home death impact the price of a listing?
Well, you wouldn't believe it, but it actually depends on the tragedy. Unfortunately, in Hong Kong, because this is such a frenetic, busy city, suicide isn't all too uncommon. So a suicide in an apartment won't bring the price down too much. A homicide, however, will really dramatically affect the price of an apartment. One example we can look at is the prestigious J Residence in Wan Chai, which is right near our central financial district. A banker there allegedly murdered two sex workers, and that has actually just gone to trial. His luxurious one-bedroom apartment actually went back on the market for 50% of the price, and that was for over $3,500 for just that one bedroom a month. So you can imagine how luxurious it actually was.
Wow.
So it really depends on the tragic event.
That's pretty macabre. But this so-called haunted overlay, how many apartments are affected?
You really wouldn't believe it. If you go to Spacious HK and you select that filter over the map.
Wait, you can actually select a filter that says haunted apartment?
You can. You go right on the map and select a filter that says haunted apartment, and these little friendly ghosts pop up all over Hong Kong. And you just wouldn't believe how many tragic events there are. In the office there, they actually have a team that takes reports from the police blotter, local media, and they keep sort of a running tab of what's going on.
Wow. Okay, so these little ghosts, that is not something that the older generation fool around with. What's going on there? What's behind this belief that you can't live in a place where someone's died?
In Hong Kong, despite what a modern metropolis this is, the local Cantonese take feng shui very seriously. The government has spent absolutely billions in making sure that new luxurious complexes aren't just nice, but that they're feng shui. Some of those factors include having an open floor plan or that the views look at the mountain or the sea. Cantonese people who are not just millennials or, of course, not expats still take that very, very seriously. And, of course, that also includes not having ghosts in the apartment.
Okay, but is just the place where the apartment is or the death occurred in specific apartments affected, not whole buildings?
See, that's a very good question. And there are no hard and fast rules when it comes to that because feng shui isn't an exact science. If you look at the J residence in the apartment where the sex workers were allegedly murdered, it turns out that the whole building was actually affected because the wealthy Chinese owners there around that apartment didn't want to live there anymore. So they started moving out from the whole building. And then, of course, all of the prices start falling.
I'm sorry to ask this because it's, you know, so tragic that you said a lot of suicides. So what if somebody jumps off a building, for example?
That's a great question, too. And it happens all too often in Hong Kong. And yes, that does reduce the price of all the apartments in the building.
So this gave one company an edge, a tech startup. Who's actually buying?
We see the trend go with wealthier expats who move into wealthier neighborhoods. One example of those neighborhoods is Po Hing Fong, which is very close to the Central Financial District. Because of the feng shui there, it's actually just built on bad fault lines. It was where the bubonic plague broke out in Hong Kong, and Chinese owners don't want to buy or even rent property there. However, it's still very expensive, and that doesn't stop wealthier expats from investing in it, and the property boom there is unbelievable, just not with Chinese owners or renters.
Is there a risk there, then, of segregating the city, you know, traditional local people separated from the expats?
I don't think there's too much of a risk of segregation because younger Chinese people here aren't afraid of ghosts. So the feng shui isn't keeping, you know, millennial Chinese people out of these neighborhoods. And of course, when it comes down to it, there are still going to be risky Chinese investors, and segregation really isn't an issue too much in Hong Kong.
So younger Chinese aren't afraid of ghosts. What about their parents? What do they have to say about their kids moving into these places?
I think that's a great question. It's so funny because I heard so many stories during that article that if those younger Chinese kids, basically, they want their dream apartment, maybe they're getting married and they finally find the one they love, but it's a haunted apartment and it comes down to it and their parents say no, they can't have the apartment in the end.
Well, Justin, thanks for the report from haunted Hong Kong.
Thank you for having me.
Justin Heifetz, he's a freelance reporter based in Hong Kong, and we found his article about the haunting practices of the real estate market there on Motherboard. You'll find a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This Halloween is expected to be a windfall for U.S. retailers, with consumer spending on the spooky holiday reaching an all-time high. Halloween doesn't get the same attention in India, but that doesn't mean they don't like a good ghost story on the subcontinent. Sandeep Roy brings us this dispatch from Kolkata.
The pumpkin is just another vegetable in India. We fry it, sauté it, grate it, but no one carves it into a jack-o'-lantern. But even if Halloween has not been embraced with the marketing fervor of Valentine's Day in India, there is no shortage of ghosts here. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. We grew up with ghost stories, like the British Governor General, whose carriage, drawn by four horses, is rumored to appear at his old mansion every New Year's Eve, while its ghostly master rummages in the house for misplaced papers. Our most famous filmmaker, Satyajit Ray, sang the song of the King of Ghosts himself in a children's film he made in the 60s. In India today, ghosts, or as we call them here, bhoots, are oddly popular. Once every film needed a sexy cabaret dancer to get the cash registers ringing. Now we need ghosts. Even the great Satyajit Ray's son, Shundip Ray, has jumped on the ghost bandwagon. He took three ghost stories, two written by his own father, and turned them into a film.
Hey, kiddo.
Bengal's greatest living actor, Soumitra Chatterjee, recently hammed it up as a ghostly king in a film called Adbhut. It's never been more fun to be dead in cinema. When Little Cole Spear said,
I see dead people.
In The Sixth Sense, a chill ran down our spines. In the recent Bengali film, The Jewelry Box, when the young bride sees her husband's dead aunt, the audience bursts out laughing. This ghost craves dried fish, plots extramarital affairs, and wants to know what sex feels like. She says all this sin-piety business is nonsense. She knows, because now that she's dead, she has first-hand information. The sleeper hit that kicked off this spooky craze was Bhuter Bhobishyat, or The Future of Ghosts. A property developer sets his greedy sights on the old mansion a band of ghosts call home. The ghosts complain they don't count for much in modern India. They are neither voters nor consumers. Eventually, they take their future into their own hands and form a cooperative resistance movement, a spirited chorus. They decide to scare the living daylights out of the promoter, not because they're particularly interested in being scary, but because it's a matter of survival. It's a feel-good movie, but in reality, the days of ghosts might be numbered. You see, our ghosts are quite social. Occasionally, they might break necks, but they usually share space with the living fairly amiably. But space itself is a luxury now. We just don't have room in a modern city of 750 square foot, two-bed, two-bath apartments for entire spectral family trees anymore. Ghosts need moldering mansions and mature trees, like the one where this Shakchunni ghost chortles nasally in a children's cereal. The buildings are being demolished. The old trees are gone. My friend San Francisco writer Andrew Lam once remembered his grandmother worrying that his grandfather, who had died during the Vietnam War, had never once visited her in her dreams in America. Andrew wrote, "Child," grandmother would sometimes ask me, "do you think ghosts can cross the ocean?" There's something even sadder about the notion of ghosts facing their expiration date at home. The maker of Bhuter Bhobishyot has a new film out, a sort of modern-day Aladdin. Its tagline is, this time, not a ghost, but a genie. The ghosts of the new India might be doomed to an eternity of going up and down the escalators at some shiny new mall listening to Muzak, a fate worse than death. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. After Shirley Jackson's short story, The Lottery, was published in The New Yorker nearly 70 years ago, readers flooded the magazine with letters. Many threatened to cancel their subscriptions. Others thought Jackson had witnessed a real stoning ritual and demanded an explanation. Still others wrote to Jackson wanting to know where they could watch the annual lottery for themselves. That was 1948. For decades, the story has since raised chilling questions about tradition and conformity in anthologies in middle school English classes. Now, 100 years after Jackson's birth, comes a new telling of the story, a graphic novel of the lottery by her grandson, Miles Hyman. Miles Hyman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Miles, your grandmother died quite suddenly when you were very young. Do you remember her at all?
I have one very sort of vague memory of her. I was only three when she passed away, and I have this image of her sitting in the kitchen preparing dinner, having a glass of bourbon and enjoying the evening. It was a very sort of fleeting image, one of those sort of early childhood impressions that one holds on to.
Yeah. Well, now your book is being released at the centennial of her birth. But you have adapted other literary classics, something of the Black Dahlia, among others, but never quite taken the lottery on until now. Why not?
You know, it was the sort of project that took some time. I really wanted to make sure that the time was right. There were also some technical sort of hesitations on my end. I for a while, figured that an illustrated version would be the way to go. Be a way to sort of preserve the original text. But as I started doing more and more graphic novels, it seemed to me that that was really the way to go at it, that it was going to allow me to create a much more intimate rapport between the reader and the story. And it's the sort of chilling tale that really gains in impact from that sort of retelling in a graphic form.
Yeah, there's a lot of wordless panels. You know, you set up the scene a little bit earlier than the story does. We get these images of a village at night, you know, this box retrieved from a storeroom. And then day breaks, just like the story at its source. There's still something eerie, you know, about these images of sheds and cornfields lurking under these scenes. So how did you approach that as a kind of visual narrative?
You know, that first scene actually came from a sentence in the original story, and I kept sort of rereading that sentence and thinking that there was something there that was going to allow me to sort of tell some important parts of the story visually. I created that first scene so that the reader has all of the information she or he needs going forward to understand the basic tools that are going to be in play, the black box, the pieces of paper, and that that we know right from the outset that there is this black dot on one of the pieces of paper that's obviously going to become a major element of the story as we go forward. And telling that scene, creating that scene, became a way to give the reader all that information in, you know, 10 short pages.
Well, your grandmother was known for a very economical, restrained prose, especially in this story, which many people know her for. Now, there are many silent panels that put, of course, a different weight on the text that you do choose to include. You know, a little bit about the flowers, this dialogue, this very matter of fact. Hi, Steve. Hi, Joe. You know,
yes,
kind of
sure.
thing. So how did you decide which text to include?
Well, I included all of the actual dialogue from the original story. And some of the narrative sequences I converted into dialogue. Dialogue is obviously far more effective in a graphic novel form than a sort of omniscient narrative. It tends to be a much more effective way of telling the story. So I did as much sort of conversion into visual form as I could. But I was very faithful to the story beyond those first scenes, which are there to replace that omniscient narrative. My drawings, one of the real goals I set up for myself doing these drawings was to find a visual language that would be as close as possible to her written language. And by that I mean when there are details, they're ambiguous. Many of the faces are seen from quite close, or we see the crowd from far away. The details and the atmosphere is there, but sometimes we're still just a little bit short of understanding exactly what is going on. And it was so important to keep that tension and to keep that ambiguity open during the entire first phase of the story, so that at the end, when we do start to understand what is actually happening, it seems to come out of nowhere.
Well, then these characters' faces, they look very, you know, hard under the June sun. And I, looking at them, maybe just historically thought of those, you know, Dorothy Lange's photographs of the Dust Bowl migrants, for example. Who did you use as models or images for those?
Oh, I used all sorts of images. I mean, many of them are just invented, but often I did spend a lot of time looking at just old photographs of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, photographs taken around America, not only in the Dust Bowl era. But no, my goal was to have these faces represent a sort of a mass of humanity, in a sense. Mm-hmm. I did. If you think about it, there are 300 characters. Or I should say 300 villagers mm-hmm. in this village, but really only about 12 that actually do anything, 12 that have any speaking parts, I would say. And the rest of them are really there just to sort of relay the tension and the anguish of what's building between them. As we hear the voices being called, sometimes you'll see people coming up, and sometimes there will be a portrait of a family. Mm-hmm. I've done quite a few different things so that we're always coming at the scene from a different angle. And it's this very long scene of names being called. It was essential to kind of find a graphic solution to make it dynamic and to make it constantly new to the reader's eye.
This is a very interesting time to be revisiting this novel. I mean, you live in Paris mostly, you know, another city that has been racked by extremist violence. In Europe, of course, this rise of popular nationalist movements, not just in Europe, but all over. So what about readers maybe discovering this story for the first time? What are they going to see?
Well, you know, it's funny. Two things. Yes, you're right that I did do many of these sketches during the whole period of the Paris attacks. There, I was also listening to news coverage of the U.S. elections. a lot of things came into play and made me realize the story remains as pertinent today as it was in 1948 in a lot of ways. Notably, the way the subject of the story tends to be about fear and about how fear changes the public discourse, and how in many ways fear allows old ideas to remain in place well beyond their due date, I would say. But yes, I would say that readers here in France, and many of whom are reading the story for the first time because it was translated years ago, but in a very bad translation, so it's not very well known, certainly not as well as in the United States, and many of them have been as shocked as the readers in the 40s were. I've had many people come up to me and ask whether it was based on real events. Mm-hmm. Some people have been really, really shocked and, I would say, almost put off by the story in ways that made me think of the letters that my grandmother received after the publication in The New Yorker in 1948.
Well, Miles Hyman, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being invited.
Miles Hyman, he's grandson of Shirley Jackson and author and artist behind the authorized graphic adaptation of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. You can find more about Miles' new adaptation at wordofmouthradio.org. Before the break, we spoke with Miles Hyman about illustrating The Lottery, that short story about herd mentality in a rural village, which was written by his grandmother, Shirley Jackson. Jackson's popular horror novels, like The Haunting of Hill House, We Have Always Lived in the Castle, and others, put a distinctly mid-century American twist on the hysterical and trapped female characters so popular in classic Gothic fiction. It may be hard to believe that the writer, derided as Virginia Werewolf, also supported her family by writing comic dispatches for women's magazines as a housewife trying to keep up with four rambunctious kids and a rambling old Vermont house. In a new biography, author Ruth Franklin explores those seemingly distinct, even contradictory genres as emblematic of the tension between creative fulfillment and the duties of motherhood that were simmering in an era when working mothers and working artists were so rare. Franklin's biography is called Shirley Jackson, A Rather Haunted Life. And in it, she presents Shirley Jackson's fiction as nothing less than the secret history of American women of her era. I spoke with Franklin just after talking with Miles about The Lottery, so I began asking her about that story and how the notoriety and the disdain as the result of that story followed Shirley Jackson for the rest of her life.
Well, immediately she paid a price in terms of the hate mail she received for that story. The New Yorker would say that they got more letters in response to The Lottery than they had ever before for any piece of fiction. And they forwarded them all on to Shirley Jackson, who actually kept them for the rest of her life in a big scrapbook that's now in her archive in the Library of Congress. And a lot of the letters were, in fact, letters of denunciation. People called her all kinds of names, said she was perverted. But a lot of them, the majority of them, actually were just confused. People were so bewildered by The Lottery and the experience of reading it, and they wanted Shirley Jackson, or really anyone, to explain to them what it meant.
Well, along with that story and the attention she got from it, along with The Haunting of Hill House and We Have Always Lived in the Castle, reinforced this image of her as a kind of macabre, gothic, a kind of witchy writer. I think someone says that she writes with a broomstick, or they call her Virginia Werewolf.
Right, not with a pen, but a broomstick, they would say.
So, but she cultivated that in some ways, didn't she?
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, she enjoyed that aspect of her persona. The jacket copy of her first novel, it said that she's the only contemporary writer who is also a practicing amateur witch. Hmm. And, you know, she wrote that copy, or at least she wrote it probably together with her husband, Stanley Hyman, who also enjoyed this kind of tinkering with her image. But she really, you know, she was, in fact, a serious student of witchcraft. She had a big library of historical witchcraft chronicles and other books on the subject. And she enjoyed playing up that aspect of her persona to reporters. She loved to tell the story, for instance, of how she claimed to have broken the publisher Alfred Knopf's leg when he went skiing in Vermont. As it happens, you know, coincidentally or not so coincidentally, depending on how you see it, Knopf was involved with in a contract dispute with Stanley Hyman at the time, and then he went skiing and happened to break his leg. And Jackson would joke that she had to wait for him to go skiing in Vermont because she wasn't allowed to do witchcraft across state lines, as we all know. So, you know, she enjoyed playing up that aspect of her character. But as you point out, she also was the author of many more lighthearted stories about her family and her absent-minded professor husband and her big menagerie of pets, stories that were just eaten up by the readers of women's magazines at the time.
Let's go back to the further earlier life, which was dark in some ways. Her mother, Geraldine, was a socialite who went, I think, beyond the traditional expectations of femininity for her daughter. She was cruel, incessantly disapproving. How did Shirley carry that in her life?
Well, yes, Geraldine was very critical of Shirley from an early age. It seems quite clear that Shirley wasn't the daughter her mother had wanted her to be. criticized her looks, her weight, her desire to sit around and daydream instead of going to social lunches and stuff like that. One of my favorite discoveries in Jackson's archive actually was a notebook in which she kept a diary during her teenage years. And on the cover of the notebook is a picture of a very proper-looking young woman with her hair nicely waved, wearing pearls. And underneath the picture is written the title, The Debutante. And someone, presumably the notebook's owner, took a very blunt pencil and very heavily scratched out the face of this nice young woman. And, you know, I feel like that kind of says everything that needs to be said about Shirley's opinion of her mother's desires for her and exactly how much she planned to go along with them. But it was a difficult relationship. Her mother really never let up on her criticism for the rest of Shirley's life. She would receive very critical letters about her writing or about her looks when photographs of her appeared in national magazines. And it was something that she seems always to have found very hurtful.
I'm speaking with the author Ruth Franklin about her biography of the author Shirley Jackson. It's called A Rather Haunted Life. But she rebelled still outwardly. You know, she became a writer. She put on weight. She married a Jewish intellectual, Stanley Hyman, who became professor at Bennington College. But this is a man who also was flagrantly and insistently unfaithful, really humiliating her, telling her about his sexual exploits, which caused her so much anguish. But she did go along with it. Why couldn't she leave him?
Well, I think, you know, it's an interesting and complicated question. And of course, it's so hard to try to understand what goes on in another person's marriage. But, you know, my guess at it would be initially when they first met, Stanley was a fairly committed communist who was a member of the Young Communist League, as, you know, so many young intellectuals were back then. And so he initially espoused the open relationship as a moral principle. Simply, he believed that there was no point in fidelity and that it was a, you know, an establishment capitalist construct that he need not obey. You know, and it became clear very early that Shirley didn't feel that way. And despite his attempts to convince her, she always was deeply hurt and distressed by his infidelities. And you know, that was a pattern that they continued to repeat throughout their relationship. But as I say in the book, I think they had a deep and intimate connection, both personally and intellectually. Stanley was a great critic who always appreciated Shirley's writing from literally the moment they met. He sought her out after reading a story she had written in a college literary magazine, which he admired at first sight. And he would always be a great champion of her work. He was a close reader of all her manuscripts, making lots of notes on them. She also read all his manuscripts. And so they had this kind of perfect symbiosis when their relationship was good of writer and critic, this wonderful intellectual connection that they also spread to their family life.
What I'm thinking about is the way that her work sometimes reflects, I think, what is going on in her life, you know, like, there are characters of women kind of, you know, constructing their own houses in the case of We Have Always Lived in the Castle, or kind of imprisoned by their own fears. And similarly, in small town New England, the idea of the locals having a kind of, I don't know, insidiousness about them. After The Lottery came out, you know, this portrayal of barbaric villagers, did people in Bennington take offense?
Well, I would say yes and no. I interviewed Larry Powers, who was the grocer in North Bennington for years and years, as was his father before him. And he insisted to me that he actually had never read The Lottery, which I found so telling, actually, that it, obviously it's a story that has attracted more attention, perhaps, than anything else by anyone who ever lived in North Bennington. And yet this man who almost literally personifies the village, you know, rejects the very idea of it and says he won't read it. You know, many people believe that The Lottery was set in North Bennington. And in fact, when you look at the way the story describes the village square, it does very much resemble that village. But you know, Jackson never actually came out and said that it was about North Bennington. She said all kinds of different things about the genesis of the lottery, including that it had its roots in Winchester, New Hampshire, where she and Stanley had lived very briefly early on in their marriage before settling in North Bennington. But, you know, she also said that it was about anti-Semitism. You know, she gave all kinds of possible spins on the lottery. But, you know, in the end, I think part of the reason that the story has endured the way it has is that it is so general and can be assigned any number of different meanings.
Well, there's a story you tell us in the book about how the lottery was written that kind of does reveal this idea that it was in her role as a mother of four raucous, creative kids that kind of unlocked a creativity in her. Tell us about the day, as she tells it, she wrote the lottery.
Right. Well, as she tells it, she got the idea for the lottery while she was out doing errands one morning. And she had her daughter in a stroller at the time, and she came home and put her daughter in a playpen and just sat down at her typewriter and wrote the story. And she says that she was done by the time her older son came home from kindergarten for lunch. So I love that story because it shows us how she managed to fit in her creative life, you know, in the breaks, in those in-between times, you know, while one child is at school or another child is napping. And, you know, that's the way that so many women writers talk about working, you know, including Alice Munro, who once said that she started writing short stories because as a mother, she didn't have the long blocks of time she needed to write novels. And I see something similar going on in Shirley Jackson's life, that she adapted her working habits to the constraints of life with children, but that she also found something fruitful in those restraints. Her children describe her sitting on a stool in the kitchen with her notebook in her hand, jotting down, you know, ideas for plots or characters while she was cooking or doing whatever else she was doing at the time. I think that's such a wonderful image and such an apt description of how she, you know, managed to make it work.
So she's a human being with a great human range, a wildly imaginative person who's able to write a book like Life Among the Savages, but also The Lottery, which, as you know, a critic said, one is as different from the other as a thunderstorm from a zephyr. So how, in looking at the life of this woman, did you come to understand somebody who called herself this compound of creatures I call me?
You know, it's funny. Stanley Edgar Hyman actually has a wonderful line about her, which he wrote in an appreciation that he published after her death. To the critics who wondered how one writer could write in two such different styles, he said that expecting Shirley Jackson, because she was the author of these suspenseful tales, to be a dark and brooding witch was on the order of expecting Herman Melville to actually be a great white whale. And, you know, I think that's a wonderful line and, you know, gets at the heart of the disjunction between biography and fiction, in that, you know, we can't extrapolate easily from the conditions of a writer's life to that writer's work. It's reflected, of course, and we can try to follow the traces. But in the end, you know, creative work comes from a mysterious place, and it can't be easily located in, you know, different scenes from a writer's life.
Ruth Franklin, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about that life.
Thank you very much.
Ruth Franklin, she's author of the book Shirley Jackson, A Rather Haunted Life. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us on this Halloween. Music today came from Uncanny Valley's D-Lay, Jason Leonard, and David Seste. A lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook and at Word of Mouth on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott. From all of us here, happy Halloween, and be careful out there. We'll be back tomorrow, too, here on NHPR.